Welcome back to All Else Equal, a podcast that mainly focuses on student questions, but sometimes just serves as a medium for Jason and I to have a conversation with someone that we're particularly interested in.
That's exactly right. Today, we're doing a follow-up to our interview to an earlier episode with Jim Sullivan, one of the co-founders of the Wilson Shehab Lab for Economic Opportunities. Oh, it's a mouthful. Or LEO.
It's not that better. The official Arts and Letters and Economics Department stances, that is not a mouthful. That's a perfect name.
LEO. Jim mentioned the work that Rob Collison is doing on homelessness and evictions, and we really wanted to get him on the program to tell us about the research he's doing.
So Rob, the Wilson family, LEO, assistant professor in the Department of Economics, which is not a mouthful to say at all, whose work focuses on housing and public economics. And in particular, he's doing really influential work related to evictions right now.
Yeah, I'm excited. Let's get Rob on. Rob, thank you for being here. Really appreciate you taking the time to chat with Forrest and I.
Yeah, Jason, thanks for having me, Forrest. Excited to talk about my work and other things.
Yeah, so we want to bring you in, talk about your research and current LEO projects you're involved with. Maybe you could just like first start with telling us, like, how did you initially get involved with housing research?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think I credit in some ways like a lot of sort of where I grew up. So I grew up in Evanston, which is just north of Chicago. And Evanston was sort of distinctive in that, like, I went to public schools and, you know, my public schools were like 40% low income, 50% non-white. And when you look to the north of Evanston, a lot of the communities that were to the north of us were sort of uniformly incredibly affluent, exclusively white sort of suburbs. And then to the south of us was Chicago, which had a lot of poverty and certainly sort of like neighborhoods that were incredibly segregated and really impoverished. It also happened that Chicago had some of like the worst public housing in the country at the time that I was growing up. And so I think I got, as I was getting introduced to topics in sort of undergrad in economics and urban economics, it was very easy for me to imagine that housing could potentially play an important role in people's lives because my community was sort of this weird mix of both the haves and the have-nots, which I thought was really interesting. And, you know, Chicago to the south had all this poverty, and then these communities to the north of us were sort of exclusively affluent. And so I got really interested in sort of why the role that housing policy played and explaining why where I grew up looked so different than both of those places. And so I think that along with sort of some early coursework by an urban economics professor at my undergrad institution got me pretty excited and interested in sort of the role that housing policy plays in people's lives.
And then you were at NYU for your PhD, right?
Yep.
And that's another place with like very interesting like housing policies, housing dynamics.
Yeah, even before that, so I've taken a little bit of a circuitous path relative to sort of a lot of people that find their way to academia. So I thought I wanted to be a sort of practitioner working in housing somehow, either sort of like in the housing policy space or in the nonprofit world. And I went to work at HUD actually for basically 4 years after I left grad school the first time and before I started NYU. So I worked at HUD during sort of the Great Recession from 2009 up to 2013, and I loved it there. It was a really terrific experience. I got a lot of sort of experiences getting to not being at the table, but being adjacent to the table where big decisions were being made, and worked with an economist named Raphael Bostic, who now leads the Atlanta Fed, and getting sort of a lot of really interesting exposure to policy conversations at a time where housing was playing a really sort of figurative role in the trajectory of the economy. And so I really liked that experience, but I found myself gravitating to research ideas while I was in that work and thinking, man, I really want to go write the paper about this. And so that's ultimately what led me to grad school. And NYU is a place that had a lot of scholars working on housing.
So then what attracted you to LEO?
Yeah, so LEO, as I kind of hinted at, like a lot of the interest in housing also came from this interest in poverty, right?
Yeah.
And so in Chicago, you know, those two things were so co-located. You had, you know, many of the worst, most distressed, disadvantaged neighborhoods also had really terrible quality public housing. And so I was interested, from the beginning in the role and the connection that poverty had with people's housing situations. And LEO was becoming this important new force in sort of studying domestic policy interventions designed to address poverty, and in particular, a lot of stuff in the housing and homelessness space. Mm-hmm. And so I think I first came across a paper that Bill Evans and Jim Sullivan had written that appeared in Science studying rapid rehousing programs, which are sort of emergency assistance given to people to prevent them from being homeless. And so I was aware of them from that work and other work that they had written. And so when I had the opportunity to come to Notre Dame and to be a part of LEO, it seemed like a really ideal fit.
So maybe we should talk like specifically about your research. Maybe you just like walk us through kind of dissertation, and then we'll talk about some current projects.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of my dissertation was focused on the issue of evictions, which has received a lot more attention nationally in the last few years. So in particular, there was a sociologist named Matt Desmond who wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning book on evictions that was primarily ethnographic in nature. And it's a really compelling book, and it's a read that I would definitely recommend. But as an economist, I was interested in sort of, hard quantitative evidence on the role that eviction plays in people's lives. And so early on in my grad school career, I saw that in New York City, in the housing court that litigates eviction cases, that cases were randomly assigned to different judges. And I knew that other work in economics had used this sort of random assignment to judges, and different judges vary in their propensity to rule in favor of eviction, or in other settings, rule in favor of guilt and incarceration. And so I thought it would be really interesting to sort of apply this setting to study the role that eviction played in people's lives. And so—
Can I ask a question? So how does a judge kind of create this type of variability in the outcomes, right? You would think that the law is pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, that's right.
What is the variance across, like, take your strictest judge and take your most lenient judge?
Yeah.
Do you have any idea, like, what the magnitude
is? Yeah. So in New York, eviction rates are somewhat lower. The rate at which judges issue an eviction order is somewhat lower than other courts. New York is somewhat more lenient than other courts in terms of the likelihood that a given tenant receives an eviction order. And so sort of the range of variation that you could kind of expect in a place like New York would maybe one judge evicts maybe 40% of its cases, his caseloads, and another judge evicts his or her, like, maybe 30% of his or her caseload. So it's
not super drastic. It's not like 10%
right?
and 80%.
And in some sense, that's good, right? From a legal perspective, we don't want, there to be incredibly different standards by which potential eviction cases are evaluated. So
from an economic perspective, maybe it would be helpful.
Yeah, it's a little helpful. Like, from a statistical perspective, because it provides more variation, but there's sort of enough variation to be able to understand the role that these differences in eviction rates play and ultimately materializing in different outcomes across judges. But just going back to Jason's question, so how do judges actually vary? So the big way that I would describe things in New York, and that's the setting that I know better, although it's not so different in Cook County, where I've also done work, is kind of in how much time tenants are permitted to potentially repay arrears. So it tends to be the case, and we can talk about this more, the vast majority of eviction cases arise because the tenant is having trouble paying. So most of them are non-payment cases in the case in New York. And so a lot of it is sort of how much the judge gives the tenant an extra couple weeks to potentially come up with rental arrears, make other arrangements, things like that, that ends up deciding whether or not an eviction order is
ultimately. So those are ultimately left up to the judge, right? So it's clear that you're in arrears, but the judge makes the decision, like, you get 2 weeks versus 4 weeks.
Yeah, in some ways, it's sort of almost more similar to something like bankruptcy court than it is like, a criminal court setting where there's a clear guilt or innocence determination. In eviction court, often the tenant is acknowledging they didn't pay. However, I would add that some tenants are not paying because there's issues with their units. And so leniency may also be like, well, the tenant only owes, $500 and not $1,000 because, they put some of their own money in to fix this, leak in the roof, and the landlord should have paid for that. So you can have differences that arise through that channel too.
So what are some of the outcomes that, like, you want to track over time? What are the costs of eviction?
Yeah, so in thinking about the costs of eviction, there's sort of big, important public costs that we're able to study, and then also private costs. And so in terms of something that's typically linked in the narrative and something that we look at is the role that eviction plays in homelessness. When people become homeless, typically they're going to emergency shelters that are sort of what people classically think of as homeless shelters, and those are exceedingly costly. So to house somebody in shelter in New York, to house a family in shelter in New York, it's about $170 per night, so about $5,000 per month.
That's so much more than I would have thought.
Yeah.
I would have thought that there's like almost like economies of scale, right? You have this big fixed cost, and the more people you get in, right? It cuts down on average. Cut down. Right?
So the big, yeah. So what drives much of that is not the housing bricks and mortar component of those costs, but instead are the costs associated with maintaining a safe and a healthy shelter environment.
So, oh, I see.
So about 60% of those costs are for sort of services that are attached to the shelter. So big ones are security, keeping it clean and hygienic, and then any additional case managers that are there to work with tenants. So there's huge administrative costs associated with operating shelter. And so sort of a lot of when you listen to advocates that are advancing policy proposals to try to reduce the number of evictions or to tackle homelessness, a big thing that's cited are sort of these fiscal costs of eviction and homelessness that arise because people end up in shelter. And so that, we were able to evaluate what's the causal effect of eviction on those. Like, you might think that, even if you don't receive an eviction order, you're pretty likely to end up in a homeless shelter because, you've got some adverse circumstance that's leading you to be, this housing unstable. And it may be the case that you just fall into homelessness anyways. And that's actually not what we find. So we do find that eviction plays, a really important role in determining ultimately whether or not a causal role in whether or not people end up in shelter. And so that ends up comprising a big portion of sort of the public costs. Another one is that we do see that evictions also seem to have a causal role in increasing hospitalizations. So it's unclear. We're not entirely sure if this is people going to an emergency room instead of a shelter, right? Looking, seeking a place to stay at night, and maybe sometimes the emergency room is an easier outlet than shelter, or whether it's because of sort of the mental health stress of getting evicted and needing to make other arrangements on very short term sort of time window that drives people to end up in emergency rooms. But we do find that eviction does sort of have a causal role in increasing likelihood of using emergency shelter.
Can I ask, because we talk a lot in economics about causality versus correlation, how are you identifying that this is a causality?
Yeah, and so this is kind of a key question, and this relates back to this randomized judge component of how things are done. So basically, we use this fact that because cases are randomly assigned to judges, if every case load that's going to Judge A versus going to Judge B should have similar rates of potential future homelessness, potential future use of emergency rooms, potential future earnings, all these things, these sort of potential outcomes for the people that go to one judge versus another should be the same by virtue of this random assignment. And so what we're going to use is that difference in the judge's tendency to ultimately lead an eviction order or, allow the tenant to avoid eviction to learn about the causal role of eviction. So basically sort of what it's equivalent to is assessing sort of how do the outcomes differ among these randomly assigned caseloads when they go to a judge that's more likely to evict versus not. So that gives us sort of this causal identification that's important for understanding the causal role of eviction. And so eviction has these sizable public costs like shelter use and emergency room use, but there's also important private costs. And when we think about private costs, that could be, just the experience and the sort of trauma of homelessness. And it's tough to quantify something like that. But, aside from just the cost to society of housing somebody in shelter, the experience of homelessness is a big ordeal and can be quite difficult, on the households involved. And so we're not able to speak to sort of, psychologically, what is the impact of becoming homeless, but we do see that eviction also seems to translate to lower earnings in like sort of the 2 years after the eviction occurs. And so the tenants in housing court that do end up evicted by virtue of going to this more difficult judge in some sense earn about 8% less in the following years. It looks like it's mostly through potentially reductions in hours worked. So it appears mostly in earnings rather than employment. And so
how do you follow that?
Yeah, so we link the tenants in housing court, and there's a lot of work that goes into this linkage, to administrative quarterly earnings data from basically state employment agencies. Okay. And so this covers really only the formal labor market. It covers about 97% of all sort of formal employment. It doesn't cover, farm jobs, which aren't a big issue in New York, but it does miss some important sources. Like, so
that's pretty amazing, though. I mean, like, that's an amazing thing. This is what Jim was talking about with, like, being able to link all these like administrative sources.
Yeah, so we're really at the sort of the golden age of new access to administrative data. And that's not to say this stuff is like always easily available. There's a lot of work that goes into accessing it. But the fact that this data exists now in a big way is a huge resource for people that do sort of implied empirical work. So that's where the source of our big earnings data.
So what are you working on now, right?
Yeah, so a lot of my work now in some ways is actually sort of responding to the changing world around us. And so, you know, Forrest at one point had been asking me about sort of whether or not I had big projects disrupted from COVID. And certainly I have a few like that. But I would say that COVID also created a lot of opportunities for interesting new questions to be studied. And so a big portion of the work that I'm working on now explores some of the policy responses to the COVID pandemic as it relates to housing and housing and economic instability. So a number of jurisdictions across the country got money from the federal government to try to, you know, prevent people from becoming homeless, prevent people from being evicted. And that became especially important during the height of the pandemic because, you know, the last thing you want in a public health crisis is to have a bunch of vulnerable populations going to congregate settings, right?
Yeah, right?
Packed into shelter. And so, you know, a big initial policy response in addition to the, you know, heavily emphasized, you know, UI benefits extensions and things like that, and the supplemental UI that was available was money that was provided to renters that were sort of at risk of losing their home. And so many jurisdictions got money from both the CARES Act and then the subsequent coronavirus relief package, and now also the American Rescue Plan, to try to basically either pay off arrears or to get ahead of potential missed rental payments into the future. And so the nice thing from a research perspective, the unfortunate thing from a policy perspective is really the initial resources that went out the door for this really weren't sufficient to meet the need. And so as a result of that, a lot of the communities that were divvying out rental money had massive oversubscription when they went out to have people apply for these resources. So, for example, I have some work in Houston and Harris County now where basically 500,000 people applied for what might be 10 or 15,000 in
wow.
potential grant money served. So, or people served under this grant money. So there was huge oversubscription, which, you know, indicates in some sense that policy was falling short of the need. But because communities were faced with these difficult decisions, a lot of them went the route of randomizing who was offered assistance.
So just give them a lottery.
So they ran lotteries. They said, you know, what's the fairest way we can give this out? Well, let's give everyone an equal shot at getting this money. You know, everybody here is vulnerable and seeking assistance. And so a lot of them randomized basically who got either this cash assistance or this rental assistance. And so I have work now pulling data from multiple different cities that undertook different sort of versions of this policy to understand sort of how effective were these or did they fall short? And if so, you know, why was that? And what can we learn about sort of the design of these programs to make them more effective?
So the research question is policy related. It's like, how effective is this at what?
Yeah, so preventing people from you know, falling into homelessness, from being evicted. Obviously, we got the eviction moratorium, potentially also measures of financial insecurity. So did this cause people to take on less debt during this period? You know, did it stabilize consumption? Things like that. So those are kind of the big picture things we're looking at. You know, within that, we've also got some potential questions around sort of, are there particular designs of these assistance programs that appear more successful than others? So, you know, some places gave out cash assistance, others required that your landlord agree to a contract that would provide them rental assistance. And so I think an important open question was like, was it better to just give people cash or was it, you know, for the purpose, at least as assessed by, you know, are you staying in your home? Are you remaining housed? Was it better to give people cash or give their landlord some money to pay off arrears? And so we're hoping to speak to that question.
The study you mentioned with Bill Evans and Jim Sullivan, with the emergency assistance in Chicago, was that cash or was that?
That was cash that was, or it was actually, no, I think so. It was rental. My recollection is it was rental assistance. It was required to be put towards either first month's rent and security deposit or to pay off some existing arrears. So my recollection is they were doing rental assistance.
But the magnitude was huge in terms of like the impact of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So homelessness is a pretty rare outcome among those that are poor. So at an absolute level, you know, the rates of homelessness are fairly low, which is nice. But there's really large relative effects of getting cash on the likelihood of becoming homeless. So it was something like a 75% reduction, I think, in their study.
No, I was just going to say overall, kind of, is it pretty clear though, because there's all these public and private costs associated with falling into homelessness, is it clear that we can spend this money and the benefits are just far outweigh the cost? Or is it still kind of gray? Yes.
So I think it comes down, a lot of that question ends up boiling down to targeting. So for, you know, the types of clients that end up, or the types of individuals that end up in something like housing court or eviction court, you know, they're often at risk of homelessness to such a high degree that, you know, you look at the amount of arrears they owe, and it's typically less than, you know, what we would think the sort of implied public and private costs of getting evicted are. But when we look more, like, you know, more broadly at how to deal with homelessness, a big issue is that, as I mentioned, you know, homelessness is somewhat rare, which is a good thing. You know, the numbers may be much higher in absolute terms than we still want as a society, but, you know, there's basically 550,000 households that are, or individuals that are experiencing homelessness on any given night in January each year.
What was the number one more time?
Yeah, about a little more than 500,000. So, okay. And so you look at that, and that seems like a high number. But, you know, you consider, say, the number of people that are living at less than 50% of the poverty line, and that number is like 20 million. And wow. So the idea that, you know, we could give all of them resources that would ultimately, you know, end homelessness, that is going to be somewhat costly. You know, I think there are normative reasons beyond the sort of positive case of dealing with these externalities that we might just want to do that, right? And that sort of depends on your preferences for redistribution. But certainly when you narrow in on these populations that are really vulnerable and seeking out assistance, they're experiencing homelessness at a much higher rate. They're also experiencing these sort of negative collateral effects of things like eviction. And so there, I think, you know, there's a pretty good bang for your buck in terms of spending there to reduce homelessness and eviction.
Now, you have an interesting policy proposal that you wrote up for Hamilton Project. Could you maybe tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is in this spirit, right? And so one thing was kind of like, we were thinking about what could we do that would be sort of different than some existing programs that would help address some of the problems of housing instability that we found in this research. And so, you know, at the one end of the spectrum, you could do things like make it really difficult for landlords to evict people through, you know, adding a lot of regulations in housing court and providing a lot of tenant protections. And, you know, in certain settings or for certain cases, that could be a nice solution. But you might worry that in doing so, you know, landlords would be pricing this difficulty of evicting tenants into their rental rates. They might screen more aggressively, and it might make the lives of low-income renters even more difficult in some sense. And so at the other extreme, we could imagine transferring a lot of resources to tenants to potentially provide them some liquidity to avoid eviction. And I think a lot of our research there points to that being a potentially fruitful avenue in terms of you look at who's entering into eviction court, and very frequently they've experienced a big negative shock. We see drops in earnings, rising hospitalizations, you know, a lot of markers of sort of adverse life events precipitating this move into eviction. And so we were trying to think about what policies would kind of square well with that particular dynamic driving a lot of housing instability. And so what we came up with on the renter side was what we were calling emergency rental assistance accounts. And the idea here was to give tenants a resource that they could draw on to get help in paying their rent when they're feeling or experiencing adverse circumstances. And so we made a couple particular design choices in this that we thought were important. So one was these particular accounts that we're proposing didn't require that you have an eviction notice or, you know, like documentation of loss of job and things like that. And we got a lot of questions about why that was. And a big reason why was that sort of when we've looked at the experience of a lot of these programs designed to do things like prevent evictions, a big barrier to ultimately getting money in the hands of people at the time that they need it most is that these documentation sort of requirements add a bunch of red tape. And so because of this red tape, often households aren't able to access assistance on a timely basis, you know, before they go accumulating months and months over arrears. And so the idea with this account was really to give the tenant flexibility in drawing down from it. It would be a finite amount of assistance. So it would be, you know, 4 months or so populated with sort of 4 months or so of subsidy that they could potentially deploy when they need it. It would have to go for housing as we designed it. So we designed it in such a way that you could imagine basically IRS creates these accounts and then tenants could fill in their landlord information and sort of direct payments to them when they know that they need this sort of buffer to prevent them from falling into homelessness. So that was what we sort of thought as an important tool on the renter side. And we think, you know, renters suffer both from these sort of secular macroeconomic shocks, but also a lot of them are falling into risk of homelessness and eviction through more sort of idiosyncratic shocks. So, you know, a relationship dissolves, your hours get cut back on work, you have a big emergency expense. A lot of times those sort of idiosyncratic shocks are things that drive this housing instability among renters. So that's where we went with the sort of design that gave renters flexibility in their ability to respond to these particular shocks by drawing down on these accounts. On the home ownership side in the Hamilton piece, we talk about an automatic program that would provide forbearance for homeowners. So one of the big lessons from the Great Recession was that we didn't have a very good infrastructure for trying to relieve distressed homeowners and make it so that they could make less payments on their mortgage during periods of difficulty. So the Great Recession, we found out basically when we had this massive macroeconomic shock combined with falling housing prices, homeowners were having a ton of difficulty in working out agreements with their servicers. And part of this goes to sort of the institutional details of how mortgage servicer arrangements work and their agreements with investors that ultimately own the mortgages. And a lesson from the Great Recession was we needed to make mortgage forbearance easier to accomplish in a way that didn't put all of the onus on the homeowner to working out these particular forbearance agreements, right? Working out agreements that would allow them to, have a few shorter payments for the ensuing months, and that additional money that they would be owed would be tacked on to the end of the mortgage. And so we didn't do that enough in the Great Recession. And so we've started to do that more effectively during the COVID crisis. There was a program that was rolled out among federally backed mortgages, so FHA, VA, Fannie and Freddie, that appears to be quite effective in helping homeowners stay in their homes during this shock. And so what we wanted to do was basically propose systematizing this more broadly to basically all mortgages.
What is it? Like, what specifically are they doing?
So what they're doing is, yeah, so often what they're doing is they're saying you don't have to make payments for the next few months as a part of forbearance, but this, it's not that that amount goes away from the ultimate principal that you owe. It just gets tacked on to you. So the life of your mortgage is extended, and that extension buys you more flexibility today and not having to make payments.
And that, now from like the institutional structure perspective, is like the bank used to own my mortgage, right? And if I was like delayed in payments, like the bank really wants me to make those payments. And so they have a big incentive to like actually like make sure that like, all right, look, you know, we'll give you a couple months off or whatever. But if like the bank gives me a mortgage and then sells it off to the ether, this is where like the finance stuff comes in that I don't really understand. If that is gone, then like, you know, these people that own these mortgage backed securities don't have an incentive to work with me to like make sure that I'm actually making my payment because I make up such a small piece of this overall security.
Exactly.
Is that right?
So often from like an NPV perspective, you want to help the home buyer or the homeowner potentially work out restructuring of their mortgage that avoids default. So, you know, it's often in the bank's best interest to not have the household go through foreclosure because that's a costly process. Banks don't like to be landlords. They're sitting on this REO property and things like that. And so, but for the reasons that you described, that sort of there's this really complicated structure now of mortgage finance where the mortgage is then sold and it's handled, the day-to-day payment or the month-to-month payment collection is handled by a servicer that then has particular contracts with investors that own the mortgage. It just adds a complexity to the possibility of restructuring the mortgage that prevents it from happening. And so, the response during COVID has been pretty significant in terms of expanding forbearance options for people with federally backed mortgages. And so we want that to be sort of more widespread ultimately in the marketplace because we think it makes financial sense and it also makes broad economic sense, right? Big waves of foreclosure aren't good for anybody. So
you would think that the market would address that on its own, right? But it doesn't seem like they're
the market with a capital M.
Yeah, right.
So I think there's big coordination challenges here, and so having some sort of leadership from the federal government may make sense.
Well, you know what we should do is have you back on in a couple of years. And actually, no, we probably won't be doing this in a couple of years. But if we are, like, we'd love to hear kind of the update from like what the effectiveness of these different things are.
I know. I think everything that happened with COVID is still playing out, obviously, right? And we're going to see for years to come some of the conclusions of some of these policies that were put into place.
But like, yeah, I'm always just kind of like super interested in like the projects that Leo and like the research affiliates are like working on. It's awesome. Round of rapid fire?
We have to.
Right? All right, good. All right, are you ready?
Yep.
So you're going to be judged on speed.
Okay.
You want to be quicker than Mary Flannery.
Okay. Very. Well, that's easy.
All right, I'll go first. So is the Biden economic miracle going to be more or less glorious than the Trump economic miracle?
After jobs report today, it might be less, but I'm hoping for more.
Okay.
Good. Least favorite place on campus?
Maybe DPAC after I had to teach there this semester.
I mean, it's a beautiful building. We love DPAC.
Yeah, we love the DeBartolo family.
Yeah, we love the DeBartolo family. But teaching in DPAC
is
not great.
Yeah, teaching in DPAC. It's a beautiful facility, but not ideal for teaching.
If they made an adult-size snoo, would you sleep in one?
Yes.
For those people
our audience is undergrads. Yeah. We have to tell them what a snoo is.
These are $1,500 cribs. That what, simulate a womb?
Yeah.
Sounds great. There we go. That's the pitch.
Don't we have Tempur-Pedic beds already that do this?
Do they wrap you in a straitjacket?
Oh.
You know, with white noise and subtle motions? Yeah.
I don't know. So I got a good one. What was the most surprising thing from COVID that you saw?
So I think it's been on this bankruptcy side, seeing big drops in personal bankruptcy and just understanding how much the federal response supported people's balance sheets was surprising. I mean, we saw, like, you look at the measures of household financial distress writ large, and they just look so much better than the Great Recession, which is a credit to the federal response, which was robust in terms of the spending.
Because some of the predictions from, like, last March and stuff like that were like, it was a nightmare. It is kind of a nightmare, but, like, man, some of the predictions were, like, way worse than what actually happened.
That's right.
Fighting Scots or fighting Irish?
Ooh. I think I gotta go fighting Scots. Sorry, guys.
All right. So just for those listening, the College of Worcester is the Fighting Scots. What's better
about fighting Scots than fighting Irish? So in that sense, maybe I should go with fighting Irish.
We won't push you on that.
Okay.
So how long do you think it's gonna take the Department of Leo to consume the Department of Economics?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm hoping before I get 10 years. So hopefully maybe 3 to 4 years.
I'm trying to like weasel my way in to be like some sort of like Leo affiliate. That way I don't get fired like the old department. Rob, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, guys.
I appreciate it.
That was great. Rob's just such an interesting guy. It was nice for us to get another Leo prof on, talk about what they're doing.
Yeah, this past year has been such a strange time in the housing sector. I mean, who would have thought that a 2x4 would be worth more than a Bitcoin at this point? But in all seriousness, for me, it was eye-opening to see income inequality highlighted in the housing sector. I'm glad we had Rob on to talk.
As always, thanks for listening, and feel free to email us at allelseequalpodcast@gmail.com.